From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we finally did it. We got Matt Levitt to agree to come on the show. He is the founder of Tahoe Blue, and we're going to talk about his journey, his entrepreneurial journey. He's had some great things happen as he grew Tahoe Blue, and we're going to hear how he started it and how he had a successful exit. And now he's doing the Compass brand strategy, and he's got some other ideas in the hopper that we may or may not be able to get into, but we're going to get to know Matt. I always, when I started the show at the beginning, I always wanted to share the stories of winning and successful people. And you and I don't know each other well, but I met you years back as Tahoe Blue was taking off, and very impressed with what you've done. And I mean, Tahoe Blue is in, it's everywhere now. So I look forward to hearing that story. So welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate you having me. Excited to be here. And it's been maybe 7 years,
six,
7 years.
Something like that, yeah.
Since last time we were together, yeah.
So. All right. Well, maybe we will start by, so where are you at now? Now you're with Compass. The name on your card is Compass Brand Strategy. So are you... Yeah. You help doing marketing?
Consulting, okay. Small business coaching, specifically on the brand strategy, marketing strategy, brand development side of things. Kind of taking what I learned, developing my own brand in Tahoe Blue. And really, after, I mean, we're kind of jumping to the end. But after 12 years in the vodka business, I thought it was time to do something else. And for now, I'm helping other entrepreneurs.
Very cool. Very cool. So you're basically a serial entrepreneur at this stage. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, there's been a few businesses along the way, and Tahoe Blue is the most recent. It was a wonderful journey, great journey.
Okay, so maybe walk me through your entrepreneurial journey, and then we'll go deep into Tahoe Blue, and then a little bit deeper into the brand strategy for Tahoe Blue and maybe other people's brand strategies as well.
Sure.
Okay, great. Sure. So take me back to the beginning when you first decided to be an entrepreneur.
Well, I don't remember exactly when the switch flipped, but I do know I was hustling toys in elementary school.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, to my friends. And then it was cars in high school. And I bought a t-shirt printing press not long after that. And at some point I had a college guidance counselor say, you really should focus on this business education with entrepreneurial focus. And so I did. So that was in Maryland. I was born and raised there, and I finished business school. And I said to my girlfriend at the time, hey, do you want to go see California and Grand Canyon and Golden Gate Bridge and the Hollywood sign all sounded so exotic and romantic when you spent your entire life in the suburbs of DC. So we went on this road trip and stumbled into Tahoe on a perfect blue June day in 2001 and just fell in love, decided to stay. And I bought into another business there, which was actually totally different industry. I had a business partner and we owned Benjamin Moore house paint stores.
Nice.
Which is fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's,
the retail stores.
Retail stores. Exactly.
Mix and paint.
A lot of employees and a lot of moving parts and managing inventory, managing people. But I learned a lot. And that was, I started my early to mid 20s running those stores and running that business. And so from there I learned people management and inventory management and at least small scale marketing and how to run credit, offer credit, and how to manage that and all those relationships. And all along the way, in the back of my head, I knew I was planning on, because that was an existing business. It had been 55 years in the works. And I knew at some point one of my many ideas, and as a, I have the classic entrepreneurs ADD of, having a new idea, sometimes it seems hourly, but daily for sure. And one of these ideas was Tahoe Blue Vodka. And I was sitting on the beach with some friends enjoying some cocktails, somebody else's vodka. I'm not going to tell you whose. I was pouring, I had a bottle of vodka in one hand and a red plastic Solo cup in the other hand, and Lake Tahoe's in the background and it's sunset and you've got, you know, the sailboats and jet skis and golfing and Adirondack chairs and crystal clear water. And that's the light bulb came on. It was like Tahoe vodka.
Vodka is such a, it's a clear liquid and it's,
clear, pure and smooth. Yeah. Just like Lake Tahoe. That we love about Lake Tahoe. Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea became, I want to capture all of this, all of that essence of Tahoe, of the lifestyle and the energy and the vibe. Because Tahoe is a place we go to relax, escape and recharge. And I wanted to bottle that.
That's cool. Offer, so that brand, how much was the brand a component of the success? I know the brand is, you know, Tahoe Blue, but I mean, obviously you've got a great product other than just the brand, I assume.
So as in most crowded CPG categories, and vodka certainly qualifies there, the brand is important. And, you know, I've seen this quote in a lot of marketing reading I've done that says, you know, 90% of a brand is between the consumer's ears.
Mm.
It's important. The feel of a brand is incredibly important. In our case, Tahoe Blue also has and has had a handful of unique features and benefits. The way it's made, the way it's distilled differently from other vodkas, which makes it smoother and easier to drink. And then you've got this philanthropy edge. And then our route to market was totally different, the way we distributed it. So there's a handful of interesting features and benefits in addition to kind of build into that brand. And that's why it's worked, because it does have to be more than a brand. Although, unfortunately, especially in spirits, a lot of the time consumers don't know how to tell the difference in quality. They need to be coached on tasting, just like with wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hints of, you know, raspberry and black cherry,
right,
Carr's water crackers, or whatever it is that your sommelier is telling you should be looking for in a wine.
Well, okay, so what's different about, and I remember you telling me this before, but what's different about Tahoe Blue in terms of the taste and all that? If you were to, I guess, describe the differentiation, mm-hmm, and why it's better?
Sure. So most vodka is made from wheat. From some sort of grain, typically wheat in the U.S. Everybody thinks that vodka is potatoes because vodka is from Eastern Europe. And 100 years ago in Eastern Europe, most vodka was made from potatoes.
Okay.
But vodka can be distilled from just about any organic matter that will ferment. And so typically, unfortunately, especially here in the U.S., the cheapest crop to make it from is wheat, because we have a wheat-based economy in the, mm-hmm, U.S. Remember the food pyramid?
Yeah.
Right.
I do.
That's marketing at its finest there. So wheat vodka, grain vodkas in general, have this inherent antiseptic bite or aftertaste that a lot of people say reminds them of rubbing alcohol.
Okay.
Because molecularly, it's not all that dissimilar from. And so the idea was, when I had this concept, and then I got a prototype bottle made, and then I took a good look into the economics of distilling and decided that's not the part of the business I wanted to get into, that my focus, my passion is on the branding, product development side and marketing, was that I knew I wanted to hire a distiller to basically co-pack, to do the distilling for me, but that I approached a handful of distillers in this interviewing process and said, I want something clear, pure, and smooth, like, mm-hmm, like Tahoe, but that tastes as little like these brands, A, B, and C, okay, leading wheat vodka brands. And when you hear wheat, people stop and think like, wait, what about, and they start naming brands, and the answer is,
well, there's,
yep,
not,
yep, that's
I don't drink a lot of vodka, but there's, it seems to me that it's one of those, drinks, if you will, that has less taste.
That's the idea.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Smoother, the better, the less, mm-hmm, signature, the less what they call structure or flavor profile of the vodka, the better it tastes drinking it neat or on the rocks, and even more so in a cocktail, where most people put vodka in a cocktail because they don't want to taste the alcohol. They want,
okay,
to kind of disappear.
Right.
So after some trial and error, settling on a distiller that I really had a great relationship with and trusted, together we kind of hatched this idea to blend a vodka. Now, blending is a process that's used frequently in whiskeys and scotches, more and more table wines. And the idea is to highlight certain characteristics of some of those ingredients while masking less desirable characteristics. Like, for example, I don't know anything about wine, so don't quote me on this, but I love Merlot for the taste, but it's dry. So you add Shiraz to Merlot and now you've got a
right. Yeah. I've been wine tasting with my wife and they're giving us those kind of descriptions. Yes.
Right. Right. And so you get kind of the better components or features of some of those ingredients. And so what we did was we first decided to blend and then started experimenting with a variety of different base ingredients. And after mixing and tasting and distilling and mixing and tasting and distilling an R&D process, it took about a year. We settled on a recipe of grapes, corn, and sugarcane.
Oh.
Which are distilled separately, then blended together.
Grapes, corn, and sugarcane.
Yep.
No wheat?
No wheat.
Oh, okay. So
gluten-free.
Okay, so yeah, the other vodkas on the market predominantly are not gluten-free, even though it seems clear.
So this is an interesting question. So vodka is a process. It's not so much a recipe. Hang in there for a second. So that process is getting to 95% or greater pure alcohol. The remaining 5% is that trace base ingredient that you made the vodka from. And for example, rum and whiskey are distilled to a lower max proof. It could be 80% or 160 proof. And that leaves more flavor from the base ingredients through the distillation process. So with vodka, that remaining 5% of the wheat likely leaves trace gluten in the vodka. It's probably low enough in concentration that it likely wouldn't trigger a reaction.
It's almost gluten-free.
Almost all gluten-free because of the process.
Okay.
And somebody with celiacs isn't going to take the chance.
Got it.
On even that.
But Tahoe Blue is gluten-free. The corn, the sugar cane.
In the process. It is 0, 0, 0.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then the taste must be slightly different, I assume.
Sure. What we get frequently is this reaction at tastings, which I've done tens of thousands of it, you know, in the early days, you know, I was the only employee. So I would go to tastings at charity fundraisers, wine tasting events, neighborhood liquor stores and restaurants. And what you get when people taste Tahoe Blue is this reaction of, wow, that's I'm doing the raised eyebrows things. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really smooth and easy to drink. And there's no bite.
Okay.
And that bite is because it's so tied to grain vodkas that we've got a little bit of grain with the corn because of the structure. We want it to taste like vodka, but not so much like those vodkas that it has that harsh bite or aftertaste. And because of that, the product has won about 35 spirits competition medals.
There's been
a lot of them.
Did I remember you? Is it healthier than other vodkas or is it similar to other vodkas?
Because
vodka generally is more healthy than some of the other hard alcohols, right?
Yeah. Well, it's lower in calories than just about anything else you can drink. And so, I mean, alcohol in general, I wouldn't venture to go so far as to say
it's not healthy for you. In moderation, but, I guess it's okay.
Yeah, in moderation. Yep. And, It's probably some of the cleanest drinking you can get. It's got fewer calories in a glass of wine. So
are people mainly using vodka? It seems to me whenever I'm with people that are drinking vodka, it's a vodka and something, right? They're vodka grape juice grapefruit juice, maybe a screwdriver or something like that.
Sure.
So they're mixing it with something where, hey, screwdriver kind of tastes like orange juice, right? Basically.
Yeah. Boy, I've seen it all.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Vodka Coke and vodka Dr. Pepper and Gatorade. And
what's the most popular things we would mix vodka with? Like,
I mean, at the bar?
Yeah.
The vodka soda,
vodka cran,
Bloody Mary, those like basic tried and true decades old drinks are still the most popular.
Yeah, vodka soda, it basically tastes like vodka watered down a little bit.
Correct.
Yeah, but then,
what it is.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly.
Add a slice of fruit and it's basically,
okay.
You get to 80 and then by adding the club soda, it brings proof back down. And so when you have a good quality spirit like Tahoe Blue, you've got that that flavor is signature flavor that comes through because you're not masking it with a bunch of juice. But at home, I think it's going to be different. I think a lot more people are doing, like what you said, like fruit juice sort of things, just trying to make it disappear.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the journey a little bit. I've dove into the product. Sure. And I'll dive into the brand a little bit more in a minute. But the journey, so it started with just you. You had this concept. You're on the beach in Tahoe enjoying yourself. And somehow you decided to take the risk because entrepreneurial endeavors are inherently extremely risky. Yeah.
Yes.
So what prompted the decision to just, I'm doing this?
I think the timing was right and my belief in the idea was instant. It was from this moment of sitting in the beach chair with some friends, watching sunset, having this cocktail, to jumping out of my beach chair and saying, hey, I've got an idea. And I went home and started doing research.
Yeah, but in this industry, it's obviously crowded. There's regulation. It's building a business. It's way different than paint stores. Mm-hmm. That seems like a kind of a leap, but are you just the type of guy that can figure anything out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for the most part, to be an entrepreneur, being in business for yourself is about problem solving, right? It's a series of, challenge, hurdle overcoming that hurdle. And so I just kind of started to piece together. I picked up a bottle of an existing.
I'm going to look at this bottle. Sure. You brought in a bottle here and I'm just looking at the packaging here.
It's happy hour somewhere.
I have another podcast to do after this one. So made with Tahoe. So you actually make it with the Tahoe water.
Yep.
I'm derailing my question though. So, okay. Sure. So you start.
So I leap up out of this beach chair and go home to start reading articles on what's involved in, and then reverse engineering another bottle of here. Would you hand me that real quick? So it's interesting, in CPG, when you walk into a store and you pick up something off the shelf, this is feels like one object, right? But for me, I'm going, okay, there's how many vendors are involved in putting this together. You got to get glass from somewhere. And then there's this whole industry of food package decorating. You got to figure out how you're going to decorate the bottle and where you're going to source the parts for that, and screen printing, cap and corks, and then the cartons that it comes in. And then of course that's before you get into the actual liquid. And so the distilling and co-packing and proofing. So there's 6-7 vendors involved in just putting this together. And so it was kind of reverse engineering an existing product and saying, okay, where do you go for cardboard boxes?
But starting from scratch like that, you're now today, and I don't know how it was in 12 years ago. I assume it was similar. A lot of times these things are getting started by like celebrities or like a lot of celebrity brands, and then they instantly take off because those people have access to make them happen. They've got a name to make it happen.
And big backing. And I was convinced that the quality and overall potential of my idea could overpower, that I could push through that not only clutter of brands, but clutter of celebrity-backed brands saying, we can be more than just putting, A-list Hollywood actor's face next to the brand.
Okay.
And so as I started to piece this together, it became more and more evident that there were not a lot of barriers to entry. Of course, you have selective hearing, right? When you're looking for the positive angle in everything you do on this sort of project. And it's really not that hard to enter the space. It is incredibly difficult to get shelf space or to get listed, for example, on a drink menu at a restaurant chain like Applebee's or Chili's or Cheesecake Factory or something like that. Those decisions are made at corporate in meeting rooms between a corporate buyer and a corporate menu engineer and a rep from a certain spirits company that will be in, 3,000 units. So
is Tahoe Blue, I think it is. It's in Bennett's restaurant, my favorite restaurant, isn't it? Yeah.
Yep.
I thought I'd seen it there.
Yep.
Yeah. I noticed it when I was sitting at the bar, Bennett's. Great. That's great. Okay.
He's been really good to us. So basically sourced the parts, took the leap, got a test batch, prototype batch made, and said, okay, here's that moment of risk. I already gambled 18 months of my life on developing it. And at that time, actually did some other small business branding consulting as well, which is really cool to fast forward 12 years and to see the businesses that I helped then thriving now 12 years later. Yeah.
Is that kind of how, so a lot of times people are reluctant to start a business because obviously there's some upfront costs in starting a business and many times not just the risk of the business not making it, but you lose your pay. Like if you got a job, where's my paycheck coming from? Mm-hmm. Did you exit the paint business? You were part owner of the paint business.
I did. I exited that business, basically sold my share back to my old business partner. Okay. The business took a beating from the real estate crash in 08, 09.
Okay.
So it seemed like 10 years there, I felt like I learned everything I could learn.
But it didn't put you in an independent, or did it put you in a position where you're independently wealthy? Sometimes selling a business can do that. It wasn't quite enough to do that for yourself.
No, it wasn't actually even enough to recover my investment.
Okay.
Gotcha. In the first one, it was one of those decent living for 10 years, but had I waited that out in hindsight for a business to come back, you know, our revenue had fallen by 60 or 70% due to the fact that nobody's working on homes for a few years there.
Gotcha. So you did your consulting.
Not a good time to exit. But
was consulting part of like paying the bills while you did the startup a little bit? So that's interesting.
So I went to work consulting and also doing some sharpshooting sales for some other businesses. And so it's kind of like cobbled together a living while I couldn't afford to take a paycheck from Tahoe Blue, which is 3 years of not getting a paycheck, which sound familiar?
So entrepreneurs out there, let's say wantrepreneurs, you're thinking about doing a startup. A lot of times you don't get paid for a long time, if ever. So it's not for everybody, but when it works, we're going to find out what happens when it works here in a minute. But when it works, it can be a really good time, a really fun ride. So you, at the beginning, you had a lot of obstacles, figuring stuff out. Was there ever an obstacle at the beginning or anywhere through the process where you're like, this is not worth it?
You know, one of the hardest parts is not being taken seriously when you call a company that sells glass bottles, for example, and say, hey, I've got this brand I'm developing. Can you quote me on 100 cases? Well, 100 cases is nothing. They do volume in the millions of cases. So it's hard to get a phone call returned. Mm-hmm. And then pitching distributors at that time, I was promptly laughed out of the room. You know, the feedback was, okay, so let me get this straight. You have a vodka brand that you're starting from your home office. You're the only employee. You have no marketing budget, no volume, no celebrity endorsement. And at this point, you haven't been working in the industry
correct, for a long period of time where you've got all the relationships. Well, they know that you're going to do something with it.
Right.
And I think that's part of like, we're building this backyard advantage. Mm-hmm. Like I was talking about, like the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And the idea with it is, how do we open those doors so that the bottle sales guy takes your call? So how do we take the relationships from our community and maybe pave the way a little bit, get you at least an appointment, or get you at least to listen to a little bit, because you're going to be venture backed and you got a shot.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, back to your story. So you're having trouble just getting the bottle guy to give you the time of day.
Just return a phone call.
Yeah.
And then you got to get to store shelves somehow. So you need some sort of route to market. And I had expected that route to market to be that a distributor would see the potential of the brand and get fired up on it and say, you know what, we normally don't work with smaller suppliers, but this makes sense to us. And we see the brilliance of the brand and sure. But we didn't. I struck out.
Going through distribution, you were striking out.
Unable to find anybody to bring the brand on after I had basically got to the point where I was ordering in the process of putting that first batch together. So after some soul searching, it became clear the most logical choice, and maybe the only choice at the time, was to self-distribute.
Yeah, just go knocking on doors.
So I got my distributor's license, the same license that the big distributors carry, you know, like a Southern Wine and Spirits or RNDC, Young's Market. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of those sound familiar, but they're the big distributors in California. So I got the same license as them.
And there's a cost to getting that license too, right?
It wasn't too bad. No, nothing like a retail liquor license because as it turns out with distributor's licenses, they're not very desirable because you have to have something to sell and you have to have an account list for them to have any value at all. So totally different. It's a lot harder to get a liquor license for a restaurant.
Okay, so you had a product and you had, a list of places that sell vodka.
I had a product and no distributor and, you know, my first order in a couple pallets, and I wanted to prove concept because in my head I figured if I could prove concept, then I could use that concept to raise some capital and then start to grow the brand from there.
Okay, so you're living in Tahoe at that time. Did you first begin by going to the local resellers, restaurants, or liquor stores, or what have you?
100%. Yeah. That's how it started. And there are a lot of familiar faces in a small town like South Lake Tahoe. So, you know, neighbors and friends' neighbors and parents of my kids' friends that run the restaurants.
And they obviously love the brand because they live up there. They love it.
Yeah, right.
So it relates.
So started there and started making some placements. I was doing, at one point, everything. I had a laptop and a printer hooked to a power inverter in a car. And then 8 or 10 cases of vodka in the trunk. So I could go make a sales call. And if I made a sale, I would then go out, open QuickBooks, build out a customer profile, run an invoice all right there in the parking lot. So I didn't have to go back and forth. And that's how it started. It was a pretty humble
door to door sales, basically.
Yes. And yeah, it was like a paper route.
I can imagine the customers in and around Tahoe, they're very familiar with Tahoe and they're buying it for, it makes sense to go into a Tahoe place and buy Tahoe, you know, vodka. But then breaking outside of Tahoe, tell me about that. Was that a huge leap?
Well, let's back up to Tahoe first. So I was there for about a year and just focused on South Lake Tahoe. And then I partnered in an old friend of mine who agreed to cover North Lake Tahoe, and we started getting some placements and disappointed. The product didn't sell. Not right at the beginning because there's 100 vodkas in the store. And if people don't know that it's there, it doesn't matter if it's the most perfect fit for the Tahoe market.
Okay. So you were able to make a sale, but it wouldn't pull through to the end user.
Pulling through. So light bulb came on. I probably need to, as much as I thought it was going to be an automatic choice for people, I probably need to invest in some advertising. So I started advertising local TV, newspaper, radio, and the product started to pull. Velocity started to pick up. It started to catch some buzz. And then people were calling us looking for it. And I went, aha, advertising. That's what was missing. So from there, I took what I learned in Tahoe to Reno. I raised some capital and launched a proper rollout campaign, TV, radio, billboards, a bunch of tastings, and really kind of hammered on Northern Nevada with Reno's epicenter of that marketing campaign. And over the next couple of years, grew Tahoe Blue from, you know, the 120th best-selling vodka in Northern Nevada to like the 18th or 15th at like every month. You pull those rankings, you know, Nielsen, IRI charts, CPG product movement, we clicked off past a few more brands.
So that's a couple of years, top 18 in a couple of years. That's pretty fast.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, obviously the absorption was good.
Encouraging. Mm-hmm. The adoption conquest rates were all really good. The reorder repurchase rates were really high. And so from there we raised more capital and turned our attention to, I'm saying our, cause it had become multiple employees. And then, you know, I partnered in a couple of people that knew more about certain aspects of the business than I did. And we'd become about 10 employees at this point and turned our sights to Sacramento and did the same thing. Capital raise, rollout campaign, TV, outdoor radio. And in the meantime, Reno kept growing. The brand kept clicking off, passing other brands and got into the top 5 in Northern Nevada, which is, you know, if you're in the top 20, you recognize all those brands.
Okay.
But in the top 5, it's like you know, for us, it was, you know, Smirnoff, Absolut, Tito's, Tahoe Blue, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so very encouraging. And then we found that Sacramento was just as receptive. You know, it's funny, your comment about the name and the place and that tie-in and how does it translate outside of the basin. Tahoe Blue actually has done as well or better in Sacramento and the Bay Area as it did in Northern Nevada.
Because we all want to go to Tahoe.
I mean, it just, the branding makes sense whether you live there or you are there or not. And I think we forget when we get used to brand names of certain products that they all came from somewhere, like 805 beer, like Ballast Point. Like,
is that an area code? Is that what that is, 805?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Ballast Point is a place in San Diego, and Gatorade came from...
Florida.
University of Florida, right? Yeah, so
I never thought about it, actually.
And at some point, I'm sure somebody said, it's about the Gators. Why would it ever sell outside of Florida? But here we are. So it's not unusual for brands to start in a place with a place name, and eventually the association with the place kind of falls away, and it becomes more of a product name than a place name, although obviously it will always be both.
So if I met you 6 or 7 years ago, was this when you were rolling out Sacramento?
Yes.
Okay. And obviously it was successful. Yep. So take us on the journey from there. Yeah.
Brand's done very well. Well, the buyers in Reno would look at Tahoe sales and say, oh, okay, well, it's selling in Tahoe, but that's Tahoe. Tahoe's going to be easy. And I'm thinking it wasn't easy, but okay. It's not going to sell in Reno, but we'll give it a shot. We'll try a couple stores and then... you know, product gains momentum and, you know, passes brands. And then that was the same in Sacramento. Well, it sells in Reno, but it's not going to sell in Sacramento. You know, we're a real market here. No offense, but this is a much bigger market and it's not going to sell here. And I said, just give it a shot and try to, and so this, and then the same thing in the Bay Area, each time somebody has said, well, of course it sells there, but it's not going to sell here. And each time it's every time we've expanded, it's worked, it's sold. So, over the course of the next few years, from 2017 to 2021, 2022, the brand started to gain a bunch of industry-facing attention, including being acknowledged as one of the fastest-growing vodka brands in the U.S. for 5 consecutive years, top 10 biggest vodka brand in Northern California, Northern Nevada, and then the entirety of the state of California at one point. Bunch of media pickups on the philanthropic aspects of the brand. We did a lot of donating along the way, and some of those were PR grand slams, like the Clean Up the Lake.
Okay.
I don't know if that got your attention at all, but we helped pay for a team of scuba divers to circumnavigate Lake Tahoe and with trash bags.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about half a mile a day. It took close to a year. Tahoe Blue is the anchor donor, and we did a matching campaign. We worked with the Tahoe Fund, and that just exploded. The PR from that was spectacular. It was picked up about 400 times. I was getting calls from family in Europe saying that they were seeing the Weather Channel picked it up and CNN.
People are probably so appreciative of you too, because if you decide to be an anchor sponsor of that or donor of that, more people sort of tag along, and it ends up becoming this huge effort, and you do a really good thing with it too. Sure. Tahoe's cleaner.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So it feels good, but it's, you know, it's helpful that it affects the business too.
I mean, it really became my passion was the preservation part, because the difference that we were making in these projects that we were working on were really pretty substantial for such a small brand that not long ago was just one employee that now is making this, you know, we undid, you know, 40 years of human impact on the environment there, and it really got everybody on board fired up because...
Interesting.
Yeah.
When I first started, so I sold my companies in 2010, 2011, and I read this book about building a socially responsible business, and that really resonated with me. I mean, I sold security cameras that I still do, and I guess that's socially responsible in some ways to keep America safer, but I wanted to do something that had more of an impact, like on my hometown, and so I have been trying to figure that out ever since. Now the Growth Factory is doing that. So But it took me a long time to figure that out. From 2010 to like 3 years ago is, you know, figuring out the growth factory and how we were really going to make a real impact on our hometown and do what I knew conceptually I wanted to do, but I never really figured it out until much, much later and a lot of, you know, getting knocked down, getting back up. So I wanted to do something like that, although it was difficult and at times I didn't know that I would really be able to figure it out. Did you want to do that at the beginning of Tahoe Blue? You knew you wanted it to be, let's call it socially responsible?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that was part of really your, that's part of your makeup.
Built into the company's roots. Yeah, we were donating long before I took a paycheck.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and so that was for a variety of reasons. First and foremost, as I said, on this road trip, I fell in love with Lake Tahoe. It changed my life. And I'm raising my kids there, and I still live there half-time. And so giving back to this place that I, you know, had this life-altering moment with that really changed the course of my life, just really had no intent to stay in Tahoe when we wandered in on that first day and just fell in love. And it just made sense to me to give back to everything we can to help preserve it for future generations.
That's, I think that's why I've started, you know, that's why I started the show, is to share stories like this. It's like my way of giving back and then helping entrepreneurs and all the different things that my team and I do today is all sort of part of like, wow, entrepreneurship was good for me. I know it's not for everybody, but if we can help the ones that are battling in the fight, then I feel like I'm doing the right thing.
That's interesting. Right. Yeah, and I feel the same with my business coaching and brand coaching. It's, we both probably have made our share of mistakes along the way. As you said, use the words, get knocked down and you get up again, you get knocked down again, you get up for again. Sure. I mean, it's not for everybody. Really important feature of entrepreneurs is optimism, because you really have to be able to push through those defeats.
Okay, so let me ask you this question, because for me, the way I stay optimistic is by sharing my story, and if somebody seems to agree and want to help, that builds my optimism more than it actually succeeding. There's nothing like succeeding that makes you more optimistic, but in the beginning, my optimism has been helped by people believing just a little bit. How do you get your optimism? How does that, is it just like innate? Mine, I sort of have to get somebody else interested, otherwise, but I got no optimism.
Well, first thing I say to myself every morning when I open my eyes is, today's going to be a good day. A lot of time I'll send that out as a text message to my kids or friends family, and so I can see it and I think about it and I know that, you know, as my kids and I have this ongoing joke, when you're skiing, we're a big snow sports family, you look where you want to go. You look between the trees, not at the trees, right? Mm-hmm. Your skis follow your eyes. And so just kind of reminding myself of that every morning, and, you know, 10, 20 second pep talk in the mirror. Sounds corny, but it works.
Well, that's the way I look at it. Whatever works for you. I get up really early in the morning and give myself a pep talk as well, if you will. I look at what's important to me and I sort of have this routine so that I can be out the door at, you know, 5:20 every morning, fired up and going to yoga for me at that time. But I want to go out at least in a good mood. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sometimes getting past myself is tough, right? Mm-hmm. Just waking up tired and, you know, maybe not quite in the mood, but the self pep talk is helpful. So that's, it's interesting.
And you got to dig deep some days.
Yeah. How bad you are on it type thing. Yes, I don't know, man. I'm not sure.
Right. But that's awesome. But we keep doing it.
Yeah. Okay. So you put people in your life that, I assume you started bringing on partners, then believed in the dream. So I'm sure that was part of the optimism. But walk me through, you start dominating, North Tahoe and, you know, the Tahoe Reno area, Sacramento works. And then from there.
So when we got as far as the Bay Area and let's say 90% of our business being, you know, if you draw like a oval bullseye over Reno to San Francisco, there's 15 million people that are covered by that bullseye, and the volume there is tremendous. So instead of spreading our, let's say, modest resources out, especially from a sales coverage, keep in mind we're still self-distributing.
Okay.
So from a sales perspective and marketing perspective and all of those things, trucking, delivery, and everything else, it became clear this business can be plenty just in Northern California, Northern Nevada. We did eventually sign on with a distributor that added Southern California, and we added some Las Vegas business along the way. We've got a little bit of Hawaii and occasional orders into Montana and Idaho and Oregon, which are control states, liquor control states, which means the state is ordering it because they're getting orders from their residents.
Okay, so you have this really successful business, and then did at one point you decided to sell or leave, or what was the transition now to, you know, you and I are talking about other things as well, whether you're be consulting and other businesses you're working on?
I think jobs, businesses, careers have a shelf life, and that my schedule is a lot like yours is now for 12 years. Of, you know, 4:45 alarm, 5:30 gym, and, you know, 12-13 hour workday, 6 days a week. And by last summer, I decided this has been great, amazing journey, and I think I'm ready to do something else. And I'd partially divested along the way, but still own a big chunk of the company. And I thought, you know, I've surrounded myself by people who have a variety of very deep business backgrounds and skill sets and expertise, and decided to pass the torch. Okay. Go do something else.
Okay. So you still own a big chunk of the company, but you don't have the day-to-day, correct. I guess, stress, the grind.
Stress.
Yeah.
Stress. And also the stress.
Yeah.
But yeah, those things. Not so much an issue anymore.
Let's dive into that a little bit. So The stress piece, what was the long hours obviously can create kinds of stress, but where did you ever identify exactly where the stress came from, and maybe what, you know, by leaving, obviously you've alleviated that. Mm-hmm. But was there like an issue or a thing?
In hindsight, I had to some degree built myself a prison in assuming too many of the company's responsibilities. I had made myself too important a piece of the puzzle with too many hats to wear. And that at one point I wanted to hire a CEO, and I said, putting this job description together, I'm looking at this going, nobody's going to do this. Nobody's going to, you know, it's at times, you know, CMO and supply chain and CEO and VP of sales. And I had my own account list that I kept from the beginning. Even though we had 20 some odd salespeople, I was still managing the company's key accounts. Mm-hmm. So, and that alone is a full-time job, much less the other four or five full-time jobs. And so I would say something I definitely learned is early on, before this whole organism that you've created becomes so dependent upon you to do a job, figure out a way to make yourself an optional piece.
Okay.
Of that puzzle, I think was, you know, critical error, but also the company got to where it was because I was there and I was doing all those jobs.
There's a book called Traction. I'm a member of the Entrepreneurs Organization, and there's a book called Traction that talks about the entrepreneurial operating system. But one of the things in that book says that your company actually becomes more valuable if it's not totally reliant on you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've felt that or seen that. Obviously at the beginning, it can't live without you.
Sure.
But now I assume it's thriving without you.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I have about as much transparency as the rest of our shareholders, which is fine. And it's in very capable hands. So I'm optimistic. But the challenge is that balance of saying, I have to do this. I'm best at this job.
That sounds like a personality style.
Yes.
Style. Personality trait. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that. It's saying when it's your vision, when you're the entrepreneur, it's parts of the job are just difficult to hand off to somebody else because you're looking at the way somebody else does the job and thinking, well, that's not.
How
that,
were
that
you?
That doesn't land as what I had in mind.
Okay, so how were you as a manager? Were you like a micromanager type person where maybe you were harder on the employees than what you wanted to be?
I'm sure I was not easy to work for.
Okay.
That being said, we were mostly a sales organization, and I have a philosophy specifically with salespeople that if they're hitting their numbers, just let them be. So definitely oversight in programs and general strategy and guidance, but micromanaging is definitely not something.
Okay.
I did my best to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I agree with you. The rainmakers in sales really don't want people hovering over them. They, right. You can't attract the rainmakers in business if you're going to hover over them.
Correct.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Yes. Agree. And so maybe making myself less important may have, I don't know, extended my longevity there, but ultimately I'm ready to start again, ready to do it again.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. So you're a branding expert. I don't know if you knew you were branding. Were you consulting on brand stuff prior to starting Tahoe Blue? Were you already considered a brand person?
Just sketching out my own little side hustles.
Yeah. But now you know you are. Look what you did. It's proof.
And I've seen it. It's incredibly validating to see not only how well Tahoe Blue has done, but also some of the other businesses I've been involved in where, you know, just looking over friends or family and other entrepreneurs' shoulders, I thought, you know, that's really cool. But what if we did this and made it more about, you know, X instead of Y, and then to see over the years. And so, yeah, I would like to think expert is generous, but I know my way around branding at this point.
Mm-hmm. Besides Tahoe Blue, give me a couple of examples of good brands and then maybe some bad brands where this is bad. Can you think of any?
Some good brands. Boy.
And why are they good? Because when I think of a good brand, I think of Apple. It's so
That's funny. That was plain. The first thing that came to mind. And then from there, I went to Sonos, which is a brand I'm particularly fond of. And those are products where you know the quality is going to be, and the not only performance, but the look and feel and touch. And I think having that holistic feeling to a product is critical. It needs to look and feel inside and out, like we know who we are.
What about how unique it is? So the Growth Factory, we've been kicking around. So our we have little gears associated with our emblem, if you will. We like the name the Growth Factory, but the gears, they're everywhere. You look anywhere and these gears are everywhere. We've had discussions about scrapping the gears and giving it something that's a little bit more unique that ties to maybe something other than a factory, if you will, but maybe to what we do. How important is, like I'm thinking of the Apple logo or any, I have the Sonos app as well. Mm-hmm. So I can picture the Sonos app on my phone, the Apple app, you know, Apple on every computer. How important is being really unique and the right emblem associated with the name?
I think it's pretty crucial. And I think when you see a brand that's just nailed it, it's obvious and you can feel it. And you connect the logo, branding, if there is some sort of, you know, catchphrase or tagline associated with the brand, along with the business name, and it all just works together. So you can take away those gears or take away the Growth Factory business name and it still means the same. You still get that.
That's where one of our partners suggested that if you took away the word Growth Factory and you just saw the gears, you'd be thinking of other companies besides us. That's where his mind mm-hmm. was, and it made sense. And then I started looking down at my phone and looking at the apps on my mm-hmm. phone and how most like my Sonos app actually says Sonos on there. Mm-hmm. It's a short word, but some of the other apps on there were just an image of an emblem of some kind that mm-hmm. you wouldn't know, but when you know, because you recognize it. So it's interesting to think about how important that is for scaling a company.
Right.
Yeah. It might not make that much difference at the beginning, but if you're going to scale it, it needs to be like, you just recognize the golden arches and it's like, it's McDonald's.
Right. It also, McDonald's was founded in a time and place that is very different from the world we live in now. There was fewer players in everything. It's like, there's not going to be another Tide, Procter and Gamble, those brands, you know, I mean, they're woven into the country's history.
Right.
And we've been seeing those brands around our houses since we were children. So,
true. Yeah. When I was a kid, I'm older than you, but there was only three TV channels and Procter and Gamble dominated the airwaves in terms of advertising. Yes. There's what, three or four laundry detergents and sure. Tide. Procter and Gamble probably had two out of the four or whatever.
They probably own all of them.
Yeah.
Yes, right. It doesn't matter which one you buy. You're probably buying a P&G product. But so Golden Arch is a great example. At one point, did it make sense? Does the Golden Arches mean hamburgers to you and I? By itself, probably not. But after 60, 70 years of seeing the two together, mm-hmm. you get there.
I think French fries.
French fries. can see that. More of an In-N-Out guy. Yeah. But is this a conversation about your gears now?
No. Okay. I'm just like, what goes, I'm thinking like when you're consulting and people are probably, so if you're going into a retail location, mm-hmm. you might be looking at the way it's laid out mm-hmm. From a brand standpoint. If you're looking at something that's doing business wholesale or online, mm-hmm. they've got to have a very, you know, they've got to have a good website, but the emblem is very important. It can't be just Joe's sure. Liquor. I mean, that might right. work on a certain corner, but I'm not drawn to it for a company that's going to scale.
It doesn't have that feeling of potential to be something that is recognizable at a glance that conveys what the business is about, mm-hmm. core mission and values, that sort of thing. So I get your point.
Yeah.
And that, I can see now that the gears are going, you're thinking about a rebrand, it sounds like.
Well, you know, it's been a discussion item about the Growth Factory. We think we have a solid brand image within mm-hmm. our community, but if we're going to go national or international, we're going to run into other gears. There's other right. gears out there all over the place. Right. And if, let's say we had an app, mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to just put the gears on there because they're more right. overdone, right. even though we had, we spent a lot of time and effort getting them right for us. We think it's, you know, maybe a little bit overused.
Yeah. So I understand. So you need something that says we help scale businesses at a glance.
Yeah. Right. Everybody has a window of opportunity. Yep. We want to be there for you during your window, right? Mm-hmm. That type of thing.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. I'm no brand expert, as you can tell. But it's fun. I think everybody at some level thinks of themselves as having some amount of creativity around mm-hmm. this kind of stuff. And so it's fun to be in discussions around sure. these kind of things. So anyway, okay. So jumping around, what did I not ask you? Let's make sure I give you the last word. What did I not ask you? And maybe any other closing thoughts to entrepreneurs out there that, you know, are out there trying to fight the good fight and, you know, do something like what you've done.
It is not for everybody, as I believe you said earlier. Requires vast amounts of enthusiasm, of optimism, of energy, but is incredibly rewarding, especially when you bring an idea to life that only exists in your head at the beginning. And I certainly made my share of mistakes, but I wouldn't change anything because you have to learn, and it's the mistakes or the learning points. And you know, I love asking successful entrepreneurs about their failures because they'll tell you, you know, there's nine failures, eight failures for every one or two successes, right?
The ones that I cried about.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you have to expect that as part of the process.
Expect failure.
Yeah. Challenges.
Love it. Well, Matt, thanks for joining me. Thanks for bringing great vodka to the world. Congratulations on all your success.
Thanks, Mark.
I look forward
appreciate
to,
you having me.
I look forward to knowing you better and watching the things you build from here on out.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show.
You bet. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.